From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tomorrow is the day of sports days. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of Major League Baseball salary arbitration hearing. a preview of Super Bowl 43. Also, why this year's Super Bowl may be remembered as the relatively frugal bowl. And we'll explore new evidence that head trauma suffered by football players leads to life-threatening brain damage. Also ahead, a musical melee between the Cardinals and the Steelers and the 15th installment of Super Bowl Haiku.
Football shoulders in. Bruise is the month when pitchers and catchers turn Scots.
I think that was an outtake. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Super Bowl 43 will transpire in Tampa tomorrow. We'll have a preview of the game a little later on in the show. But first, this week there were disclosures suggesting new evidence for the link between concussions suffered by football players and permanent debilitating brain damage. I'm joined now by Alan Schwartz, whose story about this week's medical revelations appeared in Wednesday's New York Times. Alan, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill.
Your story begins with the account of the examination of the brain of Tom McHale, who died in May of 2008 at the age of 45. Mr. McHale played in the NFL from 1987 until 1995. What made the results of the study of his brain significant?
Well, what doctors found inside the brain of Tom McHale was a condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the presence of tau protein deposits and neurofibrillary tangles that should not be there. And in fact, those things are never in the brain of regular people. They are only in the brains of people who have sustained either acute, perhaps, or more likely, chronic, repeated brain trauma. And they are not in the brains of 45-year-olds, certainly. And so what it meant was that this gentleman sustained repeated brain trauma in his life. Of course, we knew that because he played in the NFL. However, it has only recently been known that it leads to this condition, which leads to mild cognitive impairment, memory loss, and then eventually dementia as early as somebody's 50s.
Mr. McHale was the sixth of six NFL players over the age of 36 whose brains have been examined following their deaths. All six exhibited these same features. Is that right?
That's correct.
More specifically, what were the symptoms Tom McHale experienced before he died?
Well, it's a little hard to say. Of course, it's easy now to go back and say, well, that's because of this brain condition. But Tom McHale in his final years did abuse painkillers and eventually took cocaine. But his impulse control, his understanding of what he was doing was probably, although we don't know, was probably impaired by the presence of this brain damage.
Dr. Daniel Pearl, the director of neuropathology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, with whom you spoke for the article, said there is more than enough evidence that football is clearly strongly related to the presence of this pathology, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. To what extent has the NFL accepted that conclusion?
The National Football League, relying mostly upon its panel of 11 to 14 members of its mild traumatic brain injury committee, its concussion committee, they have not found the findings particularly compelling. In large part, they say, because they have not yet been written up and published in a peer review journal. Hmm. Every doctor I've spoken to has found them very compelling and very significant right now. However, the league and its doctors have basically said, you know, until it goes through that process, we don't know what its significance might be.
You characterized the discovery of CTE in all six deceased NFL players between the ages of 36 and 50 whose brains have been studied as, quote, further evidence of the dangers of improperly treated brain trauma in football. What does proper treatment of brain trauma involve?
Well, that's the problem, is there is no medical consensus on what proper is. There are treatments that are believed to be appropriate for a patient of any age. The league and its committee claim that their research suggests that professional players, i.e. those who are above the age of 22, their treatments can be far more liberal. It is such a matter of interpretation, and concussions are such individual injuries sustained by individual people with their own susceptibilities and their own recovery times and their own symptoms, and perhaps even their own genetic disposition toward long-term effects of these injuries, that having any sort of absolute game plan and absolute care regimen is misunderstanding the nature of this injury.
In an article published at Boston University on the same day your story appeared, Dr. Robert Cantu, an associate professor of neurology at the School of Medicine and co-director of BU's Center for the Study of Encephalopathy, discusses the case of an 18-year-old former football player whose brain showed signs of CTE. Dr. Cantu characterizes that finding as, quote, hugely worrisome. To what extent, if any, do you think this finding will change the way high school and college coaches respond to players who suffer head injuries?
I don't think that this one finding really will mean a whole lot, but it is part of a pattern that is getting more and more media coverage. Here we are talking about it on the eve of the Super Bowl. We're not talking about the glory of the Steelers and the Cardinals. We're talking about a public health crisis that exists in this country with respect to the treatment of head trauma in youth sports, not just football. Girls in soccer sustain a huge amount of concussions, and they're not treated properly. Basketball, lacrosse, field hockey, all of these things. And it's important for people to understand that that these injuries that are being, and this damage being found in the brains of NFL linemen, the seedlings of that damage have been found now in an 18-year-old, suggests the overwhelming care that must be taken toward these injuries.
Well, assuming that the league does at some point acknowledge a link between multiple concussions or multiple brain traumas and irreversible brain damage, what will the NFL do about that circumstance? I've heard talk about better helmets. I've also heard people dismiss that as absolutely ridiculous. It won't change anything.
Well, certainly, and that's a hypothetical, and I do not want to speak on behalf of the league. However, helmets are designed to keep the brain, skull from being fractured. And at that, it has done a very good job. Helmets are not designed to really prevent concussion. Some can be designed to better minimize concussion. What would have to happen is the rules would have to change. The rules of tackling, the rules of using your head. Very little else can change. And that's up to the league to decide if they want to consider it. I can't speak for them.
Lisa McHale, Tom McHale's widow, told you that she hoped that the results of the examination of her husband's brain would, quote, turn people's heads. To what extent does that seem likely to you?
You know, more and more people are taking this seriously. And the sixth case will get more attention than the fifth. And if there's a seventh case, that'll get more attention than the sixth. And what will probably happen is if there is ever a case where the player isn't relatively unknown, where it's, and I don't want to use any specific names, but it's a Hall of Fame player, a beloved Hall of Fame player, somebody who no one could ever consider this happening to, then it will turn even more people's heads.
Alan Schwartz is the author of New Sign of Brain Damage in the NFL, which appeared in Wednesday's New York Times. He spoke to me from Tampa, where the Super Bowl will transpire tomorrow. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
The Super Bowl is well known for its excesses and for the millions of dollars spent on it every year. In the midst of an economic downturn, what, if anything, will change at America's sporting event of sporting events? Only a Game's Dave Naylor is in Tampa this week looking for signs that the Super Bowl may not be recession-proof.
It's midweek night in a downtown Tampa bar, and the Super Bowl revelers are starting to hit town. On the street, there's the typical Super Bowl buzz, which is starting to make its way indoors. James Bronte is the manager at Hattrick's Pub.
Business has been great this week. We started to see an increase about last Friday, a little bit over a week before the big game. Every day is just gets better and better with the media and the players and the teams, and everybody's just coming to town. It's all pulling together.
But beyond the typical rush of fans to the Super Bowl city, there are signs that not everything is the same. The papers are full of stories about corporate sponsors absent from the big game, high-end parties that have been canceled, and even fewer private jets zooming into town for the weekend. Yes, times are tough indeed. James Bronte says the truest measure of the scaling back of the Super Bowl is in ticket prices, and those are down significantly from the last time Tampa hosted the game 8 years ago.
You can definitely see that it's been impacted by the downturn in the economy. Back in 2001 when the Super Bowl was here, ticket prices were higher. They weren't as readily available. From what I've heard, people are able to price hunt or search for the best deal, whereas before you pretty much take whatever you could get. Tickets from the upper levels are around $1,500, whereas, you know, previous years, you're probably $2,000.
Over at the Tampa Convention Center, Reed Sigmund is counting down the hours to the big game. He's the executive director of this year's Super Bowl host committee. Now, you might think he's down about holding a game in a recession. But in fact, with the tourist economy slumping, Sigmund says the Super Bowl comes at a perfect time.
We look at this as a great year to host the game, that this year it's going to actually have more effect on us because, you know, as our hospitality industry has had, the numbers have not been what they wanted, this will have a more positive effect. Full hotels, restaurants, and rental cars, and limousines, and all those different things that have a much bigger effect. We have small businesses in our community that are getting business. It means more to our community to have this opportunity.
Of course, only the very wealthy are able to afford Super Bowl trips with all the high rent fixings. Most people will enjoy this year's Super Bowl from the comfort of their living rooms, just as they always have. NBC political and sports commentator Keith Olbermann is part of the broadcast crew for this year's game. He reminds us that the Super Bowl at home still fits any budget, recession or no recession.
It's still free at home. You don't have to order up a pay-per-view movie. This doesn't cost you $7. And in that sense, it may be more enjoyable and more valuable to people than it would have been under the previous circumstances.
An estimated 97 million viewers will watch this year's Super Bowl. Now, there are those who would argue that the reason the economy is in trouble is because of the excesses of the past decade or so. And that if the Super Bowl has to lose some of its opulence, well, then maybe that's not such a bad thing after all. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Naylor in Tampa.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 19 minutes past the hour. It was definitely huge and it was a great event, said Mike Bassick, but he was only putting a brave face on his failure. Last weekend, Bassick, a freshman at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, tried to organize a snowball fight that would break the record set at Michigan Technological University 3 winters ago when 3,700 students snowballed each other. Though Bassick estimated his turnout at 2,000, observers with no stake in the count said the combatants numbered in the hundreds. School officials had recruited volunteer emergency medical technicians, but Bassick said injuries were limited to, quote, a few bumps and scrapes, which, given his inclination to exaggerate, probably means nobody was actually hit with a snowball. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our 15th annual edition of Super Bowl Haiku. But first, the Pittsburgh Steelers have won 5 Super Bowls. The Arizona Cardinals have had just 2 winning seasons since relocating from St. Louis in 1988 and have never reached the big game until now. Does that sound like a Super Bowl mismatch? Joining me now on the line from Tampa to preview the game is Mike Reese of the Boston Globe. Mike, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Cardinals were criticized for limping into the playoffs, 4 losses in their last 7 regular season games, and 3 of those losses were blowouts, but they beat Atlanta, Carolina, and Philadelphia in the postseason to reach the Super Bowl, of course. Have they answered their critics?
Well, I think they have, and they've certainly earned it. I was at a game on December 21st when they were up in New England, and they lost by 40 points in a snowstorm, and it looked like they didn't even want to be there. But I think once you get in, it's all about what you do with that opportunity, and they've certainly done a lot with it.
Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner is a 2-time league MVP. He took the St. Louis Rams to 2 Super Bowls, winning in 2000, losing 2 years later. But Warner is 73. I'm sorry, transpose the digits. He's really only 37 years old and having his best season since 2001. How much credit should he get for Arizona's success?
He should get a lot of the credit. You talk to people around the National Football League, and one of the things they always say is that this is a quarterback league, that when you have a good quarterback, you have a good chance to go far. And the Arizona Cardinals made a tough decision turning their offense over to Kurt Warner when they had a first-round draft pick in Matt Leinart there, but it's turned out to be the right decision.
Warner has 2 of the league's top wide receivers in Larry Fitzgerald and Anquan Boldin, and Cards running back Edgerrin James seems to have found his stride in the playoffs. Will Pittsburgh's steel curtain defense be impressed?
I think they will be, and it's a matchup of strengths against strengths, because that Arizona Cardinals passing offense is one of the best in the league, and there's no defense that's better than the Pittsburgh Steelers. They attack and harass from all angles, and one of the players that you mentioned on that Arizona Cardinals offense, Larry Fitzgerald, one of the neat stories down here in the build-up to this game is that his father is a sports writer, and he's actually been out asking questions to the Pittsburgh Steelers defenders, but I don't think I heard him say, "Guys, are you going to hurt my son?"
I love it. Anquan Boldin got a lot of attention after arguing with Cardinals offensive coordinator Todd Haley during the NFC Championship game against the Eagles. Boldin has downplayed the incident. He says he was upset about being taken out at a key point in the game. How does this particular distraction rate among pre-Super Bowl distractions of the past?
I would say it rates low. It was something that was talked about early in the week, and now it has sort of subsided, and both parties saying it's really just part of the game.
Pittsburgh won the Super Bowl under former coach Bill Cowher back in 2006, and many of that team's core players, including quarterback Ben Roethlisberger, wide receiver Hines Ward, and safety Troy Polamalu, are still with the team. But this time around, Mike Tomlin is the coach. How does Tomlin differ from his predecessor?
Well, you start, I would say, with the presence. When you used to look at Bill Cowher on the sideline, he had that big jaw, and he would oftentimes have that intimidating glare and that intense look, and Mike Tomlin is a little bit different. He's obviously younger at just 36 years old, and I think he's probably a little bit closer to some of these players because he's not that far away from some of them in age. So that would probably be the biggest thing that I see in terms of the difference between the two.
Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger might be best characterized as steady this season. Unspectacular, but steady. The Steelers are 14-4 overall. How good does Roethlisberger have to be for the Steelers to win tomorrow?
He's going to have to be a lot better than he was the last time he was in the Super Bowl, when he was quite shaky and he almost cost the Steelers that game against the Seattle Seahawks. It all comes down to maturity for Ben Roethlisberger, and one of the things that both teams have talked about is his remarkable ability to make something out of nothing. And he will have a play that is breaking down in front of him, and he'll somehow find a way to elude a defender and make a great play out of it. And I think the Steelers will need a lot more of that.
One of Pittsburgh's defensive stars, end James Harrison, was cut 3 times by the Steelers. He was also cut once by Baltimore. This year, he was selected for his 2nd consecutive Pro Bowl. Tell us about Harrison's turnaround and what he adds to the Steelers' defense.
It's a remarkable story of perseverance. He was actually out looking to get a license to either drive buses or drive trucks, and he stuck with it. And actually what happened is the player ahead of him on the depth chart dropped a weight on his foot in the weight room, and they looked to the next guy and said, "All right, James Harrison, you're up." So I think sometimes the weight of those barbells can really work in your favor when your name is James Harrison.
We've talked about some of the stars from both teams, Mike, but are there other Cardinals or Steelers we ought to have our eye on tomorrow as game changers?
You don't talk too much about the kickers, but oftentimes, as we've seen, kickers can play a big role in the Super Bowl. So Neil Rackers of Arizona and Jeff Reed of the Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, if it's going to require a field goal to win the game, which one of those guys will be more equipped to come through in the clutch?
Well, I'm going to ask you to answer your own question, at least insofar as which team will come through in the clutch. Who wins this thing?
I'm going to say the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think the chance to get that record 6 Super Bowl championship, and just having been here just a few years ago, I think they're the more powerful team.
Mike Reese writes about the NFL for the Boston Globe. He joined me from Tampa. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much.
In addition to actual football, tomorrow's Super Bowl broadcast will feature the Battle of the Advertisers in the biggest arena they'll find all year, about 97 million viewers. Media analyst John Carroll predicts it'll be a low-scoring affair.
It's been 25 years since Apple Computer ran its landmark 1984 television commercial, which single-handedly turned the annual Super Bowl broadcast into an adstravaganza. The spot depicted an Orwellian dystopia in which consumers were totalitarian tools and IBM was Big Brother.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
The following year, of course, Apple ran the equally legendary Lemmings disaster, which proved conclusively that people are okay with being depicted as totalitarian tools, but draw the line at being compared to small rodents. The undisputed MVP of Super Bowl ads is Coca-Cola's Mean Joe Green commercial, which was very much like the soft drink, sweet and syrupy.
Want my Coke? It's okay, you can have it.
No, no.
Really, you can have it.
Okay.
There's not much to smile about these days, though, especially since the price of Super Bowl advertising has risen dramatically. This year, it's $3 million for a 30-second ad. That's $100,000 a second for those of you following along on your calculators. But as the cost of the ads has gone up, the quality has gone down. For the past few years, Super Bowl spots have tried too hard, gotten too much pre-press, and generally wound up being overhyped underachievers. And that's not including the downright offensive ads. Start with the juvenile sexism of internet domain name registrar GoDaddy.com, whose 3-year run of Super Bowl ads has invariably involved the busty brunette who can't keep her shirt on. Add to that the borderline racism of the recent Super Bowl ads for mailing list broker Sales Genie. One animated spot features husband and wife pandas who run Ling Ling's Bamboo Furniture Shack.
Ting Ting, we have no customers, no sales. We're going out of business.
Ling Ling, I am not going back to the zoo.
Then we need a sales.
Rounding out the bad taste trifecta is the sugar-coated homophobia of the 2007 Snickers ad that showed two guys eating the candy bar from opposite ends until they practically kiss, then rip out their chest hair to reaffirm their manhood. Tomorrow, you can count on seeing the perennial Anheuser-Busch Dog and Pony Show, a smiley face ad from Coca-Cola, and a doggone cute commercial from Pedigree Pet Food. What you can't count on is a Super Bowl advertising lineup free of offensive material. Prepare your defense accordingly.
John Carroll is senior media analyst for WBUR Boston and a mass communication professor at Boston University. Among the recent email to our mailbag, or whatever it is that holds email, was this one from Dave Shadowin, who hears Only a Game on WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Super Bowl Sunday, winter of our discontent, TooFew.com ads. Pretty clever the way Dave has combined a celebration of Super Bowl Sunday with a comment on the nation's economic woes, all in the form of a haiku. Yes, 5 syllables, then 7, then 5, it's haiku. I wonder, would it be worth it for us to try some more of that for the 15th time?
XLIII. Carved in stone, carved in brush cuts. XLIII.
red on blue sky, bird swoops, dances in bright air, dips, dumps on smart money. The smart money says Pittsburgh. Cheap, chirps the cardinal.
Wrong. Nothing's cheap here.
Football shoulders in. Bruise is the month when pitchers and catchers report.
Ten large gets your seat on the 50-yard line, right?
Nope. Madoff got it.
Banks Super Bowl ad. Empty vault, manacled suit. Crawl reads, "Send money!"
The Eagles landed, not on the moon, in a heap.
Not Houston's problem.
Train wreck in Tampa. Seismic Sunshine State struggle.
Football game today!
Security's tight, fans tight, loaded, howling drunk, won't be allowed guns.
Steelheads, he called them. My cousin Dave in Pittsburgh. Steelheads. Why was that?
Watching the big game. In Philly, Coach Reed eats everything he sees.
On the field, snap, crack, blink, you're on your back, out cold.
TV slows it down.
Kurt Warner recalls his first Super Bowl. Recalls, too, the Civil War.
Rare Roethlisberger. Well done, Ben Roethlisberger.
Oh, the fun we have.
Red runs cardinal blood.
Hell, it's pro football, baby. They all gonna bleed.
But for a bullet, bang, down the leg of a fool.
They might be giants.
At the bench's end sits the man who hates himself, hopes his teammate fails.
Cardinals, Steelers, the bang-up guy won't recall which one he played for.
Is it football, then?
You pick it up in your hands.
It's not football, mate.
Big Ben Roethlisberger. Grrr.
Troy Polamalu. Warm sand. Cool breeze. Pick's pocket.
Super Bowl Haiku XV featured, as always, the Only A Game Hut Hut Haiku players, consisting this time around of Walter Dixon, Clint Cavanaugh, James Isaacs, Anna Benstead, George Hicks, Kirsten Kalkhurst, Jonathan Peck, and coming out of retirement, Christine Fischera and Pamela Grimaud. You're listening to Only a Game. The story in last week's program about the enormously successful men's squash team at Trinity College and their coach, Paul Asiante, inspired Gary Brandt, who hears Only a Game on WXXI in Rochester, New York, to email: I currently coach high school hockey and coached at Cornell until my retirement in 2006, Mr. Brandt wrote. Coach Asiante's point about maintaining focus is essential for championship-level play. I will share this story with my fellow coaches and the team. Among the listeners responding to my conversation last week with L. John Wertheim, the author of Blood in the Cage, was Jonathan Smith, who hears the program on WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. I was a little surprised and annoyed that you simply accepted Mr. Wertheim's association of the word patriotism with right-wing politics, jingoism, and libertarianism, he wrote. The latter, in particular, is a selfish, irresponsible ideology that is the opposite of what I think of as patriotism. This association may be of a piece with Mr. Wertheim's claim that the sport he promotes is pure because its violence lacks moral ambiguity, exactly the sort of thinking that has dragged the country down for the past 8 years. Otherwise, as always, thanks for the great show. Pat Dolan, a WBUR listener, had some problems with L. John Wertheim's enthusiasm for Ultimate Fighting, too. I would like a follow-up on the man who was so violently kicked in the head, he wrote. Mr. Wertheim happily reported that he was not paralyzed. Can he still think, make jokes, and understand numbers? Can he filter out distractions and concentrate? Is he paralyzed by an inability to make even simple decisions? Can he control his aggression? These are very typical effects of brain injury from violent blows to the head. Last week, Charlie Pierce and I discussed what London will be spending to host the Olympics in 2012. The conversation provoked Alan Wallace, who hears the program on WRNI in Rhode Island, to write, "One part of the London Olympics construction has been completed ahead of time and under budget, the Olympic sailing venue at the Weymouth and Portland Sailing Center." It's always good to close with good news, I think. If you have any, or if you just want to let us know what you think about the program, write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
John D. Murphy lives in Lynn, Massachusetts, so it's a pretty fair bet that he's a fan of the New England Patriots. Perhaps that will be cited as a potentially mitigating circumstance when Mr. Murphy, who owns a moving company, attempts to explain in court how he allegedly came into possession of $2 million worth of jewelry, including New York Giants Super Bowl rings. According to police, one of the rings was found in Murphy's bedroom. How he'll explain the other stolen property, reportedly in his car and his safe deposit box, nobody knows. But regarding the rings, what are the chances he employs the Patriots should have won that Super Bowl defense? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the Steelers and Cardinals get flagged for having too many melodies on the field. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Now, be honest. How many players on either team are named Melody?
Moving right along, we have mentioned, of course, the big game a number of times already in the program. But tradition dictates that I ask now for your annual characterization of the Super Bowl. And so?
The Super Bowl is good.
Has anything that's happened over the past 2 weeks led you to think the Cardinals can upset the Steelers tomorrow?
No, and I'm not falling for any of the pundits who have had 2 weeks in la-la land and have decided they have to shill for this game. Pittsburgh is better than Arizona. It's entirely possible Arizona will win, since the only thing that has defeated them so far is the fact that the delicate flowers don't seem to like to play in bad weather. The weather's going to be fine.
It'll be fine.
We might get a decent game. I think Pittsburgh's going to beat them anyway.
All right, here's a Super Bowl-related story bound to surprise you. A group called Common Sense Media claims that sex and violence are represented frequently in the ads that run during football telecasts. Can this be true?
Yeah, well, I believe it. I mean, 500 of the ads, according to this study, showed an increased form of violence, including murders, explosions, and gunfights. Can we look at the data a little deeply? How many of these ads are for movies?
Ads for television shows.
The Common Sense Media, who did this little survey, seemed to be very impressed or appalled by the fact that 40% of the football games show ads for erectile dysfunction drugs. These people tend to say, well, that's sex. Well, yes, but it's also public health, I think.
Roger Federer, finalist at the Australian Open, is on the brink of winning Grand Slam title number XIV, to put the achievement in Super Bowl terms. You like his chances against arch nemesis Rafael Nadal?
I would like these guys to play in the finals of all four Grand Slam tournaments. Nadal almost didn't get there. He had to play five sets against Fernando Verdasco. If Federer were to win this match, this would set up the tennis season in a very interesting way.
This week, Serena Williams set the record for career winnings by a female athlete in any sport, breaking Annika Sorenstam's record of just under $23 million. And it doesn't appear as if she'll slow down anytime soon.
No, Annika, of course, has retired and taken herself out of the game. Serena Williams is going very strong. She's certainly gone by her sister, which was an even money bet when they both started out.
Yes, although perhaps she carried her sister. They did win the doubles title in Australia. Alex Rodriguez has reportedly told friends that he's not at all upset with his former manager, Joe Torre, for writing that among the Yankees, A-Rod is known as A-Fraud. Why not? Come on. This had the potential to be a great winter baseball story.
Well, give it a minute.
Let's get it going here.
Yeah, Joe Torre is now embarking on his media tour, which is going to include several very large and important television shows. And we'll see how sanguine A-Rod is about his recently revealed nickname, which everybody I know ever has called him since he came to the Yankees. You know, I mean, we'll see how sanguine he is about that by the fourth stop on the Joe Torre media tour.
Barry Bonds' perjury trial is slated to begin on March 2nd. There were new claims this week from an anonymous source that Bonds had used steroids other than the clear and the cream, despite his testimony before a federal grand jury that he had not done that. What's the outlook for Bonds at this point, Charlie?
I think things are looking a little bit dimmer than they did 2 weeks ago. There's a catcher named Bobby Estalella who is apparently going to testify that he has firsthand knowledge of Bonds' alleged steroid use. You know, lie to me, lie to people with notebooks. Don't lie to federal grand juries. It's just really dumb.
The Amgen Tour of California begins 2 weeks from today, and it features well-known, if not infamous, cyclists Lance Armstrong, Ivan Basso, Tyler Hamilton, and Floyd Landis. Are you surprised to see these riders at a sporting event sponsored by a pharmaceutical company?
This is terrific, and I have our producer, Karen Gibbon, to point out. These are her notes, so you can see them right here.
See, yes.
She wrote them in the text for me. Lance Armstrong, quote-unquote, allegedly tested positive. Ivan Basso admitted to, quote, attempted doping. Floyd Landis tested positive for steroids. Tyler Hamilton tested positive, blood doping. Thank you, Karen. I'm looking forward to this event.
Should be fast. The NBA All-Star reserves were named this week. Any reservations concerning those reserves?
Yeah, I think the Boston Celtics point guard, Rajon Rondo, got cheated a little bit. He's having a fine season. He didn't make the All-Star team. Shaquille O'Neal got back in the All-Star game on the merits, which is an interesting development. He's having a terrific year.
Should we be feeling good about Los Angeles Galaxy midfielder David Beckham because he's been playing well enough so that AC Milan wants him to remain in Italy, or should we be feeling bad about him because he's just one more player with no respect for his contract?
Can I vote for C? Who cares? Hit me over the head with a hammer if you ever mention David Beckham to me again. Look, I don't believe for a minute that he's torn between going to AC Milan and being a superstar in a place like Milan and playing in a fifth-rate minor league here in the United States of America. I mean, he may feel that for public consumption, but I think if you gave, sorry about that, I think if you gave him his druthers, he'd be in Milan tomorrow.
Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, et al. Have had sneakers named after them. Chuck Taylor, too, as I remember. Now Adidas has moved beyond naming their athletic shoes after sports stars. So, can I sign you up for a pair of Yoda trainers?
$150. Such a sucker you are.
Finally, Charlie, Mexico has had trouble beating the U.S. in soccer when the two teams have played in this country, at least. How do you like the strategy the Mexican team wants to employ for the World Cup qualifiers scheduled for February 11th out in Columbus, Ohio?
First of all, what the heck is Radio Shack doing in here? A Mexican sports daily called The Record is inviting fans to clip a coupon and redeem it at the local Mexican Radio Shack store for a voodoo doll likeness of a U.S. player. The illustration of the coupon shows a pair of scissors slicing off the leg of a doll in a U.S. jersey. Oddly enough, the press office of Radio Shack in Fort Worth, Texas, is not immediately returning phone calls as far as the chain's involvement in black magic. I just wish they'd give me attachment for my iPod that worked.
You don't suppose this story might turn up on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, do you?
I don't have any idea, but I know now why David Beckham is much better off in AC Milan than he is in L.A.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course, he joins me here each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Helpful you are.
What if the outcome of the Super Bowl didn't depend on time spent on the practice field or in the film room? What if the Super Bowl winner were determined by the music celebrating the team? Who would win? Here to help us figure out which team would win Super Bowl XLIII based solely on its fight songs are the hosts of American Public Media's Sound Opinions, who join me now from Chicago Public Radio, Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot. Welcome to Only a Game.
You bet. Good to be here.
We should acknowledge right from the outset that the Steelers are favored by a touchdown in tomorrow's Super Bowl, and for every one Cardinals fight song, the Steelers have about 10. But let's not favor quantity over quality, if quality is the right word in this exercise at all. Let's get right into some song-to-song competition, all right?
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to start with Steelers Polka by Jimmy Sahulis, an oldie written for the 1978 team that beat the Cowboys in that Super Bowl. But the song, it seems to me, sounds much older.
We're from the town with the great football team. We cheer the Pittsburgh Steelers. Chuck Moll and all his friends are all on the beat. Go out and get them Steelers.
The tune isn't exactly original. It's based on the Pennsylvania polka, but it's catchy,
right,
and the lyrics seem to work. What do you think, guys?
You know, you got to be careful when you do polkas in front of Chicago, guys. I mean, we're talking about the biggest Polish population outside of Warsaw here, man.
It's true.
My parents have been dancing to polkas since they were born. They come from the old country. They settle in Chicago.
This just means you're qualified. You're ready to make a judgment.
He knows polka,
uh-huh, and that is not good polka.
My parents would sit that one out. They'd sit that one out. They go, who is this guy?
It's an embarrassment.
This guy's no Jimmy Sturr, I got to tell you.
No.
All right, well, moving right along, the Cardinals have only been in Arizona since 1988, but Only a Game's crack team of music researchers has found at least one song that dates from the team's days in St. Louis. The song was apparently written in 1960, but it can still be heard at home games. Here it is. A little bit of a predictable beginning to that one, but is it a worthy opponent for the Steeler song that we heard just before it?
I think so. I think that railroaded right over the Steelers. I mean,
they were in tune. That was a good thing.
At least when it comes to Super Bowl music, when it comes to football music, I think it's a mistake. You know, you get into trouble when you go with this newfangled pop stuff. You have MTV run the halftime show.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you're staring at Janet Jackson's nipple, right? You know, it's like go with the old marching band thing. I mean, mm-hmm, it was perfectly mm-hmm fine. You know, it's sort of sad that the Cardinals, when that song was written, they had to share it with the baseball team. It was the fight song for both the baseball team and the football team.
Right, right.
But, you know, I mean, it's a classic, march around, get going.
I agree with you. The marching bands with the choreography where they'd make the designs on the field while they were playing, they need to bring that back.
And you got to love the tuba.
All right. So, in the category of old-time fight song, clearly the winner is the Cardinals.
Yeah, give it to St. Louis. Yeah.
Okay.
They got the line game. It's all about the running game and the line play, right?
I don't know
what that means. I don't follow baseball, but...
Let's talk about songs adapted for use by football fans. Here we're going to put up a reworking of Pat Benatar's Heartbreaker by the Pop Rocks. This is a group of Steelers fans who just happen to be between the ages of 11 and 13. And then we're going to put up How About Them Cardinals by two Phoenix area DJs called Tim and Willie, which is based on George Strait's How About Them Cowgirls. So, first, the Pop Rocks.
Steeler tea, we're the
All right, and now the Pop Rock's more seasoned competition. We got Tim and Willie.
I think Kurt Warner is the league MVP. Then there's Darnell Dockett and DRC. Man, they play football. And all I can say is, how about them Cardinals?
Who's got the edge here? All right, the young rockers, who are, fittingly, from Harmony, Pennsylvania, or the older crooners from Arizona.
God. I don't know why you would cover George Strait and go for, like, bad Carpenters in Vegas cheese. You know, I think Tim and Willie blew it completely for St. Louis there. I admire the Pop Rocks. You know, I thought they were good. They got a violin. They got an electronic drum set. Mm-hmm. The YouTube video. At least they're not playing Guitar Hero.
You know, there was something less studied about her vocal. I mean, the guy who was doing the How About Them Cardinals song sounded so mannered. It sounded like one of those bad Glenn Frey solo records from the 80s. I mean, The phrasing was so stiff and so stilted. I mean, I give it to that 13-year-old girl. She had it all over him.
She had the spirit. I have a suspicion that, like, her dad wrote the song or something. They were not great punk rock, but they were good.
All right, well, this is getting exciting because we've got ourselves a tie, and so we move into the final category. Finally, in the original song category, we have Road to Sixburg by Ryan Parker. This is a guy who's written songs about nearly every team in every city. So here we go.
Used to be Terry Bradshaw. Now these days it's Big Ben. Who's making sure that the Steelers are gonna win it again? From Lynn Swann and John Stallworth, right on down to Heinz Ward. The Steeler bus is still rolling with Mike Tomlin on board.
All right, the Sixburg in the title refers to a potential sixth Super Bowl title for the Steelers. Ryan Parker's up against a group called Golden Cousins, and they've got a song called We Do This Together.
You'll be hurting when Carlos and Burt give you the biz. Defense designed by Clancy and Coach Wiz. QBs on other teams, they're telling lay still, son. You just got hit by Adrian Wilson.
Yo, don't let your QB feel safe in the pocket. Kid, we keep making hits like Darnell Dockett. We in the bird's nest. All guests get scarred, plus a bunch of bird droppings on the visitors' cars. You can't stop the six.
All right, those songs are quite different, though perhaps equally hideous. They both employ excellent use of name dropping, I think. If you had to pick a winner, where would you go with this one?
Oh, my God, it's horrible. Do you remember the Super Bowl Shuffle? Again, a Chicago reference, because it reminds me, that Golden Cousins songs reminded me of the previously worst song of all time.
Oh, it's
the
an
Super
embarrassment.
Bowl
Shuffle. That one's an embarrassment.
What
and the other one's
video.
No better, though. The other one stinks even worse. I mean, I like the kids, right, Greg?
Oh, are you talking about overall or between those two songs?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the only thing we heard that has, like, a spark of, like, originality and just personality.
Well, spirit, yeah, personality.
Spirit. They got the attitude.
All right, so Heartbreaker by the Pop Rocks has kicked Pittsburgh over the top, according to my tally, and this is just fine. I know that you cover a range of genres on Sound Opinions. What do you look for in sports music, whether it be a fight song or music played at live sporting events or whatever, that it might speak to you?
It's all about getting the adrenaline up, getting the crowd pumped up. That's what it's all about. I mean, beyond that, I'm not sure what purpose it serves. Nobody's really paying attention to the lyrics. And unless something really spectacular happens, like, you know, Janet Jackson doing an impromptu striptease, nobody remembers what the halftime entertainment is at the Super Bowl either. As a music fan or an appreciator, it has no place in an arena.
Well, you know, you mentioned Janet Jackson, and the Super Bowl halftime show has featured performers as diverse as the Rolling Stones, Prince, Aerosmith, Britney Spears, even Mickey Rooney and George Burns back in 1987. Have you guys a favorite among halftime performers?
I was big on Up With People. I think when Up With People did it, that was about the highlight of, and it's all been downhill since. It's a bad idea to, you know, I mean, essentially Springsteen is going to get 10 minutes of free advertising for this new album. Has nothing to do with anything.
Sure. You know, I think one of the most spectacular moments is when they went on this big PC kick after Nipplegate. They decided, okay, we're only going to get clean, wholesome entertainers now, and they got Prince.
Yeah,
I thought that's just genius. And then he did the little silhouette with the guitar and all that stuff, and you're going, wow, this is playing out to 100 million people across America.
It's go back to the marching bands. That's what we were saying before with the Cardinals fight song. It's like that's what belongs there.
Jim DeRogatis is a music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Greg Kot writes about music for the Chicago Tribune. They host American Public Media's Sound Opinions, which they call the world's only rock and roll talk show. Jim and Greg, thank you very much for refereeing today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Our pleasure.
Palamalo. 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 Man, rockless man in the bar. Billy Wagner's fast.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Brian Fadham, Glenn Alexander, Michael Garth, and Pierre Miller of CBC Montreal. Special thanks to Robin Lynn at Sound Opinions and to the 2009 Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Sound Opinions co-host Greg Kot, who identifies whence sports music emanates.
It's the seventh ring of hell, I think.
Well, yeah, except for dying Cub fans' last request. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Palamalo. Palamalo. Palamalo.
Hello?
Palamalo.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.